medical experts have called for Sputnik to be approved for use in Italy, where the vaccination program has been hampered by late deliveries of other vaccines. Roberto Speranza, the Italian health minister, said if Sputnik got approval, then it would be used in Italy. If a vaccine works and if EMA and IFA say that it is safe and effective, then nationality doesn't interest me, he added. The European Medicines Agency, EMA, which has so far authorized the use of BioNTech, Pfizer, Moderna and AstraZeneca vaccines, began assessing the Russian Sputnik V vaccine on 4th of March this year.
On Sunday, people across the United States held marches and rallies to denounce the recent rise in anti-Asian hate crimes in the country. Protesters hit the streets in New York, San Francisco, Portland, and several other cities to show solidarity with the Asian American community. The demonstrations were held days after a gunman attacked three spots in the U.S. city of Atlanta, Georgia, killing eight people, six of whom were Asian women. The police are investigating whether the shooting spree was racially motivated, but the recent upsurge of verbal and physical attacks against the ethnic minority has raised serious concerns. The escalation of anti-Asian racism is attributed, for the most part, to the rhetoric adopted by former U.S. President Donald Trump after the novel coronavirus broke out in the country in March last year.
It's a disease, without question, has more names than any disease in history. I can name Kung Flu. I can name 19 different versions of names.
Why do you keep using this?
Because it comes from China.
A lot of people say it's racist.
It's not racist at all, no, not at all. It comes from China.
But that's unlikely to be the only reason why the Asian community is increasingly coming under attack.
A lot of this anti-Asian violence and racism has been simmering underneath the surface of the United States for centuries now. Trump is only a product or a symptom of what's been white nationalist and white supremacist legislation, policies, and ideologies that have existed within the U.S. for since its foundation.
Last year saw waves of anti-racism protests across the U.S. re-sparked following the death of George Floyd at the hands of a white Minneapolis police officer. With Trump no longer in the White House, many hoped things would turn for the better. But it seems like the former president has made a lasting impression that's proving hard to undo. The first instances of anti-Asian racism in the United States date back to the 1800s. The list includes the Chinese Massacre of 1871 in Los Angeles and the adoption of the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882, which led to a sharp decline in the Chinese population in the U.S. Following the bombing of Pearl Harbor in 1942, the U.S. government relocated over 120,000 Japanese Americans to 10 internment camps across the country, who lived under terrible conditions for up to 3 years.
The U.S. has a history of not only, you know, discriminating against Asians, but discriminating against anyone who was not white, be it Mexicans or Mexican Americans after the Mexican American War, or the history of enslavement, the history of genocide against Native indigenous folks, and the history of barring Arabs and Muslims from coming into the country or labeling them as terrorists or some other evil enemies of the United States. Every non-white group in the United States has really suffered institutionally and legally from the policies of the United States government.
Asian Americans are also encumbered by another set of biases in the context of their social life, that is, the stereotypes. They're generally regarded as hardworking, intelligent, and economically independent individuals. While the descriptions are mostly favorable, they hide other underlying issues, including racism, poverty, labor abuse, and psychological needs felt by the working-class Asian Americans. The model minority myth also hurts other communities by creating a paragon for them to look up to. Several instances of violence against the African-American community sparked outrage across the country over the past year. The protests are now being extended to confront the issue of systemic racism and racial injustice against members of other minority groups in the U.S. This begs the question, can the cause be a force to challenge the deep-seated prejudice against the minorities?
Facebook has once again shut down the page of Press TV News Network, this time permanently, in yet another attack by the U.S.-based social media giant on Iranian media outlets. Facebook said in a note that this decision is irreversible. The company attempted to shut down Press TV's account without giving any prior warning. Facebook justified the act by claiming that Press TV has failed to follow the Facebook community standards. However, the company did not specify the so-called violations of its rules. The social media platform has, on a number of occasions, attacked Press TV, despite its own claim of providing space for freedom of expression. One such attack took place in mid-January, when Facebook temporarily deleted Press TV's page, which had more than 4 million followers. The news outlet, however, had its page restored after appealing the platform's decision to remove it. The attack coincided with Press TV's coverage of post-election violence in the U.S. Press TV has repeatedly fallen victim to censorship, not just on Facebook, but also on other fronts, including Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. Over the past years, Facebook, along with other mentioned companies, have repeatedly targeted Press TV, among other media outlets of Iran, and the countries critical of the West and the Israeli regime's occupation of Palestine. It appears that the UK has also followed the footsteps of the US when it comes to censoring media. The UK broadcast regulator Ofcom recently stripped the Chinese media company of operating on its cable network, an exact move that it did to Iran's Press TV back in 2012.
I think we need to recognize that in today's day and age, the various social media, in particular we're talking about Facebook today, is being weaponized in the tools of the Western powers to actually try and make sure that the agendas that Western powers have are going to be promoted, and anyone that is resisting or saying different things to what the Western powers want to hear and want other people to hear outside, they're going to try and make sure that those voices are suppressed.
In June 2020, Facebook labeled Iran's Press TV, Russia's Sputnik, and China's Xinhua news agency as state media, saying that it would block them from running advertisements in the U.S., which views the three countries as its arch enemies. The state media labels did not apply to the BBC, Deutsche Welle, or other government-funded Western news agencies, nor to those accounts funded by the U.S. government, such as Radio Free Europe. That is a clear case of double standards. Facebook had in 2018 targeted hundreds of accounts that it claimed were tied to Iran and Russia, under the pretext of fighting misinformation campaigns. While American social media platforms do not hesitate to silence the voice of Iranian media under the pretext of policy violations, they offer a free hand to anti-Muslim hate groups and Iranophobes under the banner of freedom of expression and a blatant double standard policy.
I think the idea of freedom of speech within the Western world is something that has been promoted by the Western powers, and it's a myth. When you look at the detail of what's actually going on in terms of what people are able to articulate and the parameters within which they're actually allowed to operate, what you see is that whatever the flavor of the month is, whatever the fashion is in terms of the political fashion about what should and should not be said, then if anyone goes outside of those parameters or criticizes things that are outside of those parameters that Western powers want to have criticized, and they will not allow that.
Facebook and other Western social media networks have repeatedly attacked Iranian news networks like Press TV and Hispan TV. Yet their allegations have been baseless. Therefore, there's a clear case of double standards. Western media cannot stand those who are critical of their policies, those who speak the truth, and of those who are the voice of the voiceless, as Press TV's slogan goes.
Thousands of Yemenis rallied across the country to show their support for the popular Ansarullah movement and reiterate their strong resistance in the face of the devastating Saudi-led military campaign as the Yemen war entered its seventh year. People from all walks of life gathered in Sabine Square in central Sana'a since the early hours of Friday morning, waving the red, white, and black national flags. They chanted slogans against Saudi Arabia, which leads the military coalition against Yemen, and denounced U.S. support for it. Yemenis say the seventh year of the war will mark a departure from the rest, as the army has ramped up its retaliatory attacks against Saudi targets and made significant advances against Saudi-backed mercenaries. The recent spate of attacks seems to have had an impact on Saudi's policy in Yemen. Last week, Prince Faisal bin Farhan Al Saud presented a so-called peace initiative to end the conflict in Yemen, which would include reopening Sana'a's airport and allowing fuel and food imports through Hodeidah port, both of which are under the control of Ansarullah movement. The Ansarullah movement, however, dismissed the plan as fruitless unless the war ends and the years-long siege on Yemen is lifted.
It does appear that Saudi Arabia is attempting to withdraw. It has lost, of course, significant support from the United States for its war effort. So the fact that it has requested another ceasefire, although this is one that has been mentioned in the past unsuccessfully, but the fact they're bringing it up again at this time does indicate that Saudi Arabia sees that it is in a never-ending war that it cannot win.
Yemen says it will press on with its attacks until the other side puts an end to its aggression.
This war has to end. And to underscore our commitment, we are ending all American support for offensive operations in the war in Yemen, including relevant arms sales.
The announcement raised hopes that Saudi hostilities against Yemen would end soon, but even that couldn't stop the Saudis from keeping up their onslaught on the war-ravaged country. While former U.S. President Donald Trump maintained close relationships with Saudi officials, including Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, and provided Riyadh with abundant support, his predecessor, Barack Obama, wasn't free from blame either, as the Yemen war broke out during his administration when Joe Biden was serving as the vice president. Saudi Arabia, backed by the U.S. and its other regional allies, launched a devastating military campaign on Yemen in March 2015 with the goal of bringing Riyadh-backed former President Abdurrabbuh Mansour Hadi's government back to power and crushing the popular Ansarullah movement. That goal has not been fulfilled thanks to the resistance put up by Ansarullah throughout 6 years of indiscriminate war and blockade. What Saudi Arabia assumed to be a short conflict turned to an all-out war, killing hundreds of thousands and displacing millions.
The U.S. has always been as guilty as the Saudis because it has supported the war. It has provided Saudi Arabia with billions of dollars of weaponry, which has been used to slaughter the Yemeni people. This has continued. The United States has withdrawn some of the sales that it has made to Saudi Arabia, but it continues with some others. So it isn't as if it has stopped the flow of weapons to Saudi Arabia, weapons that that country is using to attempt to destroy Yemen. So the United States is complicit in this, as it has been from the start. This is nothing new, just because it's a new administration. The Biden administration mirrors the policies in this regard of the Trump administration, of the Obama administration, of the Clinton, Bush, going all the way back decades. The United States is a war-making and war-mongering nation. It supports wars of its allies if it will in some way enhance its profits and power throughout the world. This hasn't changed with Biden. It won't change with Biden. It's tragic, but the Yemeni people are continuing to fight and will until they are free.
Observers believe the Biden administration can only show its seriousness in ending the conflict by placing additional pressure on the Saudis to cease the violence and seek a diplomatic solution. Whether or not the U.S. is willing to do that to its regional ally is anybody's guess.
Israel appears to be in the midst of another political deadlock after its fourth general election in less than 2 years. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who's become Israel's longest-serving prime minister after 12 years in power, had hoped that this week's election would give him another term. He tried hard to unite a right-wing coalition behind him, but apparently that has not happened. The 71-year-old's right-wing bloc has once again failed to secure enough votes for a parliamentary majority. His bloc is 9 seats short of a necessary 61-seat threshold. It is now far from clear who would get the mandate to form the next cabinet. If he wants to stay in power, Netanyahu will probably have to build a coalition involving Jewish ultra-Orthodox and ultra-nationalist parties. Netanyahu may even have to seek the support of a Palestinian party, which in a surprise development has managed to win several seats. Meanwhile, Netanyahu's opponents, who could somehow reach a parliamentary majority, are far from united and are unlikely to be able to agree to cooperate. It is still too soon to know whether this election will prove to be inconclusive. If neither bloc succeeds, Israel could be headed for a fifth general election since 2019. Some analysts believe the regime is experiencing its worst political crisis in decades. The Israeli Prime Minister is in deep trouble because this week's election was widely viewed as a referendum on his leadership. Netanyahu's election campaign focused on his much-talked-about COVID-19 vaccination program and his push to normalize ties with some Arab states. But his opponents insist he mishandled the pandemic. Meanwhile, they argue that he should not remain in office while being tried on corruption charges. Netanyahu is the first incumbent Israeli prime minister to be indicted after being formally charged with corruption. He has denied any wrongdoing and insists that he will not try to block the trial. But critics are not buying that. They suspect that if he finally forms a parliamentary majority, he may seek action at the Knesset to delay or end the legal process.
If he can form a coalition government, he will certainly appoint someone as the Attorney General who will quash the corruption charges against him. So, I mean, it's not simply the question of forming a government for him. It's a question for him of staying out of prison, because let's face it, Israeli police have been after him for some time, and they have enough evidence.
Meanwhile, as Israeli political parties wrangle over how to proceed from this point, Palestinians in the occupied territories are showing less interest in Israeli politics. This is perhaps because the Palestinian issue was not mentioned much during electoral campaigns by Israeli parties. The regime has been demolishing Palestinian homes, seizing their lands, and building on them over the past decades.
We're going to continue to see exactly what we have been seeing over the past years, and that is the continuation of a settlement expansion. The ousting of Palestinians from East Jerusalem, the continued dispossession of the Bedouin in the Negev.
This has been an unchanging policy, and no new cabinet is expected to halt that.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we invite you to listen to a speech by Sheikh Hamza Sodagian.
A'udhu billah min ash-shaytan al-la'in al-rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Alhamdulillah Rabbil Alameen. Wassalatu wassalam ala Sayyidina wa Nabiyyina wa Habib Qulubina wa Tabib Nufusina wa Shafi'i Dhunubina wa Abil Qasim al-Mustafa Muhammad wa ala Ahli Baytihi al-Tayyibin al-Tahirin. One of the mistakes we make is talk a lot, chatter a lot about this stuff, about what I do or what I want to do or what I did, where my mind is, what my heart is, what my feelings are towards that stuff. There's a account, just to tell you what some of our urafa have said. There was one of the scholars that is known as an arif. I won't mention his name because this is not a very good thing that I'm saying. He's still known as an arif. Atla Khushvacht was in that individual. They went to Allama Tabatabai for their spiritual sessions and lessons together. And Atla Khushvacht had gone to Allama Tabatabai before this individual had. Later on in their older age, this, I guess, co-student or this brother that was in the same class with Atla Khushvacht going to Allama Tabatabai, there were a few of them. This individual was interviewed by one of the periodicals, I believe it was a newspaper in Iran, some time ago, maybe about 20 years ago, a little less probably, about maybe between 15 and 20 years ago. It was an interview, and in that interview he had been asked, and he shared, that individual that's referred to as an arif, he had shared his feelings, his experiences. For example, he had said that in the early days that we were with Allama Tabatabai, the feelings we got were such that when, meaning he said, I got, he was talking about himself, not about others, that I would be walking in the streets and just anything I saw was a sign of Allah, and that just made my heart tremble and I would cry. He shared that experience and other things as well. And then he said that there was a dream I had. In the dream, I saw another classmate of mine, or a classmate of mine with Allama Tabatabai, whose name is Aziz. And Aziz is Ayatullah Khushvacht. His name is Azizullah Khushvacht. He said, I saw this individual extending an arm from above to me and telling me to grab a hold of my arm and my hand. He said, I told the next day when I woke up, I told Allama Tabatabai this. Some of the people who knew Ayatollah Khushvacht and knew of his past and who he was with and so on, when they read that article, they were intrigued. And this is another thing. We get intrigued and we get curious, interested in knowing some of these things without being interested in the goals, the objectives. These things are intriguing to us. We like to read about them. We like to discuss them, but we don't really want to take any serious steps, and that's the unfortunate thing. Let me not get sidetracked here. They got interested and intrigued. They went to Atla Khushvacht and they read this article from beginning to the end. I heard this from a teacher of mine who used to be a student of Atla Khushvacht. He said, I wasn't there, but my friends that were there, they said, they read the whole thing. Ayatollah Khosrow was just sitting there, just looking up as usual. And he heard the whole thing. We were expecting them, once the article at least is done, that he's going to say something. So the article was done. He just got up and went to the bathroom. And after the bathroom, there's only one thing he said. He said, if he had taken my hand, he wouldn't have said these things. Okay. You shouldn't share your experiences. We don't really have any of those types of experiences. I guess I'm speaking from my own experience. Maybe some of you do. But whatever experience that we feel is a blessing from Allah, is spiritual, we're not supposed to share it. We're not supposed to tell everybody about it and talk to everybody about it. If we are trying to get closer to Allah, one of the important secrets of that path is secrecy, is keeping the mouth shut, is not telling others. The nafs wants to discuss these matters. The nafs doesn't want to keep that in. The nafs, that desire to show off, is not only in the material realm and material blessings, which unfortunately we deal with. When it comes to spiritual things, we have a serious problem with that as well. Keep it, if God has blessed us with something, we have to keep it to ourselves. If we were blessed with doing a dua, a ziyarah, a special feeling, a tear, a cry for Abu Abdullah al-Hussein, shedding tears in repentance to Allah, doing the night prayer, whatever it is, hide it. That's between you and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. If it's shared with others, more than likely it is shared because of the nafs. The effect of that is, I will lose that blessing. Riya, as we have in the Holy Quran, a little reference to it in regards to sadaqat, which is generally inclusive of mustahabbat as well. Sometimes there's riya at the beginning, and when I'm doing the action, I'm doing riya. And the whole purpose, the whole objective of me doing something is to show off to others. That's one form of riya. Sometimes when I'm doing it, I'm careful. Oh, I made sure nobody knows. It's between me and Allah. I'm doing it for Allah. Later on, shaitan comes in and gets into us and wants us to share it with others. That makes it riya. It ruins the effects of the acts. It's according to at least some of our ulama, there isn't really a difference between when initially doing it, having that ill intention, or later on developing that ill intention towards it. They will both ruin the action. It's not done for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. With some of these pointers in mind, we hope and we ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to give us tawfiq this year to do His ibadah. Ibadah is not doing acts. It's not abstinence from food and drink. The essence of ibadah is the intention, the thought process, what's in the heart. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala mentions this many times in the Quran in different ways. I don't want to discuss some of the examples that are there. I think we've shared some of them before. But we ask Him to give us and bless us with the ability to be engaged in real ibadah. Ibadah means being His slave, seeing that we have nothing of ourselves, no decision, no nothing. We act according to what He says, want what He says, desire what He says, and move in the direction that He wants, inshallah.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karim Azim Alim Halim Hakim Mateen Shabbat محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمني صلوا عليه.
Inside Israel.
There is an increase in social welfare cases across Israel. This is because there's dangerous levels of conditions and violence at home and in society. More people in Israel are seeking help than ever before. This includes hundreds of thousands of families. Many of them have sought help for the first time.
It's exceedingly much worse than last year. Our services are exponentially rising. The stats are in front of me. Our amount of food baskets that we give is from 3,500 a week to 4,500 a week. It's more than a 30% increase. There are hundreds of thousands of new poor that are seeking our services.
This is according to Organization of Directors of Social Affairs Offices in Local Authorities. This organization represents 150 welfare organizations across Israel. The report says that children are the most at risk. There has been an increase in social welfare cases. This is due to the significant number of families seeking help due to dangerous conditions and cases of violence at home. The coronavirus pandemic, along with a political deadlock and no budget, have brought hundreds of thousands of new families to social service departments. This is due to the economic and social distress they are facing. Hundreds of thousands of families have sought state help for the first time. Data also shows a 20% increase in children at risk. There's also a 26% spike in domestic violence. The numbers are from a group of directors of social affairs offices. They are known as the Organization of Directors of Social Affairs Offices in Local Authorities. The organization represents 150 welfare organizations across Israel. In a report it published in January, the organization claims that there is also a 21.5% rise in the number of calls relating to youth or young adults in distress. There is an affiliated rise in the number of young people threatening or attempting to commit suicide. The data relate to hundreds of thousands of citizens who have appealed for help and reflect not only a dramatic increase in the number of new applications, but also in the scope of issues involved. On social media, the conversation took a different turn. On Twitter, Gilad says, in Israel, the leading NGO that supports youth at risk published their numbers, and they are horrendous. Increase of 5 times numbers in youth cases, 4.8 times anxiety and depression, 2 times eating disorders, 5 times domestic violence, 2 times self-abuse, and today we launch another lockdown. Andre says he bets that nobody would be held accountable. Women's Voices says the number of complaints of domestic violence in Israel increased by 300% since March, attributed in part to the 2 coronavirus pandemic-induced closures and the subsequent economic crisis.
I'm self-employed, and I haven't really worked in a year. So all of a sudden, I'm also in a different kind of economic situation. The smart people do what they can, but I don't think there really is anybody that's... We were hit with a pandemic we didn't see coming. Nobody knew how to deal with it. And that includes the government. You know, we looked to them, but they're just as clueless. Even today, after a year later, nobody's really sure what's really going on.
Thank you.
There's been a rise of about 68% of calls reporting domestic violence from Israeli homes to the resource centers and emergency centers. The problem is that we've actually seen a very big decline in elderly people calling, and there's a very high chance, according to various experts, that elderly people are being abused, but they are unable to call. And additionally, we've seen a rise of reports from women and children who are undergoing abuse. The problem is that many children cannot be seen in the schools by the teachers, so the only contact they have with them is through Skype or through Zoom, and that is why they are unable to really know about their condition and situation. There's no doubt that there's been a very high rise of violence against children in various homes, and larger numbers of children are suffering. The problem is that if a child goes to school, it's possible to possibly identify if he exhibits certain behavior that shows that he's been beaten at home or may have scars or the way he speaks or isolates himself. In the Zoom era, it's much harder. So while some teachers are somehow able to sense that something is wrong with some students, there's probably a much larger percentage of number of students who are being underreported or invisible for the violence that they're being on the receiving end of. And due to unemployment and high pressure and lack of adequate services, there's growing incidents of violence in many homes, and it's all the various after effects are also taking place, including homelessness and extreme violence. The Israeli government didn't really address the issue of violence in homes, although there's been a very large increase. So many of the organizations who are dealing with this have been overwhelmed. So there really hasn't been a new budget in the country. There's a lack of funding for organizations and for asylums and for schools. So due to all these reasons, there's been a massive underfunding, and this issue has been to a large degree unrecognized and underplayed by the Israeli government.
Since last year, there has been a significant increase in the number of children who urgently need shelter. Among the reasons for this are reports of suspected assault on minors, physically and sexually, and in towns that are considered economically strong. The number of young men and women hanging out in the streets without an educational framework has increased. The directors of social affairs offices demanded the regime establish emergency shelters for children of youth and men who live on the streets and do not have any family support. In the wake of the large number of young men who have been dismissed from their work and forced to leave their apartments, the situation is prevalent in all circles of Israeli society. In fact, in late 2020, the Women's International Zionist Organization, WIZO, a volunteer organization dedicated to social welfare that monitored the amount of calls to domestic violence hotlines, admitted that domestic violence in Israel has increased by 300%. Since the start of 2020, some 20 women were murdered by their spouse, with 18 of the murders having occurred after the coronavirus pandemic first broke out in Israel in March last year. The report also noted a 350% increase in the number of women asking for help in centers for the prevention and treatment of domestic violence. Of course, women are only another victim. According to the Organization of Directors of Social Affairs Offices in Local Authorities, the coronavirus pandemic has brought hundreds of thousands of new families to social service departments due to the economic distress they are facing. On social media, the conversation took a different turn. Kathy on Twitter says, "We do need to be prepared for a revolution. Who is going to lead and how do we gather and plan?" Rachel asks, how can we trust the regime to protect women when there is no consensus within our own justice system that domestic violence should be taken seriously? How can we expect women to believe that they are entitled to leave violent relationships when our courts tell them otherwise? Woman for Just says, so why did the right block an investigation of domestic violence and murder of women in Israel?
Because people in the end do what they want to do. And even now we're in a quarantine, but people are walking around. I can go wherever I want. So maybe in a sense, had they enforced it more, but you know, there's only so much. People have to take a personal responsibility also, is what I'm saying.
כנראה שהמוסדות שצריכים לקבל את הכסף, כל מיני מוסדות רווחה, כל מיני מקומות שצריכים לתמוך באנשים האלה, לא מקבלים תקציב, עמותות לא מקבלים תקציב, ובשביל זה אין להם כסף. האנשים האלה נהיו יותר מסכנים ממה שהיו.
That I have something to say about, because when I watch the news and I hear people talking about the government and vote for this one and elections, people are dying in the streets. I mean, not in the streets, but people are dying. We have much more important things to do than worrying about some Knesset member's seat. Yeah, I don't care about that. I mean, I'll vote, but I'm not going to invest my energy right now in this. We have more important things to do.
The Israeli government did not open up new centers for abused women. And although there's been a growing number of unemployed and homeless people in the streets, the Israeli government didn't create new centers or host people in new locations. All around the world, in multiple areas, in San Francisco, in Scotland, in London, the local governments and the national governments have been making very big and largely successful efforts in housing homeless people in different locations. The Israeli regime did not do this. It did not create new centers for people. It did not find new locations for people. And also, to a large degree, many Israelis did not want to host homeless people in many areas, whether hotels or Airbnb or other areas. So this did not happen. Right now, there are circumstances in which many fathers and husbands cannot provide for their family. And this, in a growing number of cases, is resulting in violence within the house. Additionally, many children and elderly living within the nuclear family and wives and mothers are encountering violence from their spouses or husbands. And the number of resources available and funding for solutions for this growing domestic violence is entirely inadequate. Additionally, due to the fact that Israel is currently undergoing its third lockdown, there's been the schools have been closed, as have most employment areas, and that is why there's been lack of proper education and a healthy environment for many students. In the last 10 to 15 years and longer, we've seen a gradual decline of various social services provided by the state to the citizens. And there's been a cutting of funds, so every year the budget has been getting smaller, and then in the last 2 years there was no budget altogether. But what is unique about this current COVID-19 situation is that the Israeli government is not creating new areas or hiring spaces where people could live and taking them off the streets. So the only thing they did is make some centers that were available already during the night. They made them also available during the day. but the number of homeless people is increasing, and there are many children in the streets, and the government is not doing anything about it, and people are growing up without any kind of guidance, which is a very dangerous and explosive situation. To begin with, Israel did not really allocate any new funds to the growing social problems that are taking place. Its only answer historically has been to provide more policing. But right now we have a situation with so many homeless people and so much violence within families and such a poor response from the country. You need to wonder, what are they thinking and why aren't they taking care of their own citizens? So what Israel could have done differently was to find solutions for homeless people, find new areas where they could be housed, because the state owns a lot of territory, so they could have been housed there, and have more of a workforce that could visit families and check on children and elderly and see how they're doing on a one-to-one level of visiting.
So far, there is no plan by the regime to address the issues mentioned, but it is likely that even when the pandemic is over, there will be great pressure on social services due to post-traumatic effects. But what is really worrying is that these figures and numbers are huge for such a small entity such as Israel, and Israeli media is questioning whether or not Israel was ever prepared, and how the effects of the political deadlock have truly impacted Israelis, as politicians flex their political muscle while Israelis are forced to live out on the streets. Here are the news making the press in Israel. Haaretz: suicidal tendencies among school pupils up 42% this school year. Educational advisors reported having received tens of thousands of new requests for treatment by students seeking support for loneliness, distress, anxiety, and sexual abuse, according to a new report by Israel's National Council for the Child. Ynet News: Israel's settler population in the occupied West Bank has grown at a far higher rate than the rest of Israel as a whole over the last 4 years, a pro-settler group said, a period that coincides with unprecedented acceptance of settlement activity from former U.S. President Donald Trump's administration. The report by West Bank Jewish Population Stats shows the settler population growing by around 13% since the start of 2017 to reach 475,481. During the same period, Israel's population grew by around 8% to reach nearly 9.3 million, according to the regime. Globes: Israel's Attorney General Avichai Mandelblit has decided to indict, subject to a hearing, former senior executives at Shikun & Binoy Holdings Limited, as well as the company itself, on suspicion of bribing public officials in Africa in order to win infrastructure tenders in Kenya and other countries, sources inform Globes. The Times of Israel: a bill stepping up enforcement of the coronavirus lockdown by doubling fines for violators passes final votes in the Knesset and will become law. The measure was the focus of fierce infighting among the parties in the coalition and had threatened to hold up a vote on extending the nationwide coronavirus lockdown.
From me and the production team here at Inside Israel, it's goodbye for now.
Months after the Persian Gulf War, Abir was born into a poor family in Iraq amid the destruction left from the conflict. Her father Qasim was the guard of a date garden and her mother Fakhriya a housewife. Abir had two younger brothers, Muhammad and Ahmad. She also had a sister. Her name was Hadil, the youngest member of the family. She spent her days helping her mother with the housework. The area they lived in was not safe, though. As a result, her parents would not allow her to go to school. But something happened that was a glimmer of hope for little Abir. U.S. forces set up a checkpoint close to Abir and her family's house. This promised improved security. It also meant a safer commute for them. But Abir's mother was feeling more worried than ever before. One day, American soldiers came to inspect their house. Stephen Green, one of the soldiers, ran his finger down Abir's cheek. That scared her a lot, and she ran away.
Is it true that Abir, the what appears to be her age 14 years old now, had already told her mother that she was afraid of the soldiers, that they were making advances to her at the checkpoint?
Indeed, I have been told by this relative that Abir expressed her concern to her mother about 10 days ago.
Stephen Green dropped out of school when he was 19. Later, he joined the army after he got his diploma through distant learning. Enrolling in the army was an easy decision, he said, which for him meant doing one's duty to protect the country. He said, "I think if I did not join the army, I would have overlooked my duty. By joining the army, you gain a position, a job. This gives you opportunities to change your life." Green was deployed to Iraq as a member of the parachute forces of the 101 group of the USA Army. And from there, he was sent to a checkpoint in Mahmoudiya in south of Baghdad. From the same checkpoint, close to Abir's house, U.S. soldiers Green, Cortez, Barker, Spielman, and Howard watched her attending daily chores and taking care of the little garden in the yard. Fakhriya had seen them several times, staring at Abir and showing one another thumbs up. Fakhriya got more worried. That was why she asked her neighbor to let Abir stay in their house that night. But, according to documents released by the FBI, on March 11th, 2006, Stephen Green and his accomplice fellow soldiers thought of a vicious plan that would kill all the hopes of Abir's parents. The next morning, March 12th, 2006, the soldiers, all in their early 20s, sneaked out of the trees and attacked Fakhriya's house. Specialist James Barker writes, "After the breakfast of March 12, 2006, we went for the house of a girl who passed daily by our base. We saw the hunt at the entrance of the alley. Spielman and Green forced the girl and her father into the house. Then Green took the father, mother, and the younger sister to the bedroom. We kept Abir in the living room. Suddenly, Paul Cortez pushed the girl to the ground and tore down her pants in a second. I took the girl's hands and Paul raped her. Then Paul took the hands of the little girl and I raped her. That was when we heard several gunshots. Then we saw Green coming out of the bedroom with an AK-47 in his hand, saying, 'I just killed them. All are dead.' He put down the gun. Paul took the girl's hands again, and this time Green raped her. Green then took the gun and shot the girl in the head. She died immediately. But Green was not satisfied. He started shooting at her dead body. Barker says, 'I took a lamp from the kitchen and poured all of its oil on the girl's body. I don't remember which one of us set the fire. Abir's body burned.' Green went to the kitchen and fetched the propane gas capsule, saying we should escape from this house without leaving a single trace before it's burned down to ashes. At first, the media reported that the family members were killed after they had opened fire on U.S. Army forces in Iraq. 7 days after the horrible incident, Justin Watt told his commander, 'I heard from Brian Howard that Stephen Green had killed the four members of that innocent family.'"
Yeah, this is messed up, man. He's like, "You remember that family? That family that got murdered?" And I was like, which family, you know, and he's like, you know, the one near checkpoint two, the one with the little girl and the, like the 14, 15 year old girl. I was like, yeah, Raj. He's like, that was us, man. And I was like, I'm sorry. And he was just like, yeah, that was, Green did that.
The U.S. military has identified four soldiers charged with raping.
Set her body on fire to destroy the evidence and murdered her parents and her 6-year-old sister.
He had an AK-47 rifle in his hand. He said, they're all dead. I killed them.
On August 17, 2006, the American lyricist, reporter, and writer Robin Morgan wrote a report with the title, Their Bodies as Weapons. When the news about sneaking in, spreading fear, and killing of the young girl was out, the United States of America tried to play down the brutality of our soldiers. Our media first pretended that the victim was a 25-year-old, and then even a 50-year-old Iraqi woman, and said the other three people who were killed were Abir's children. On the one hand, the wise and alert Americans were busy twisting the age of the Iraqi lady and making her look older. And on the other hand, finding the national ID certificate, the investigators realized that the birth date of Abir Qasim Hamza al-Janabi was August 19, 1991. After the jury of Kentucky Court failed to agree unanimously on the death sentence for Stephen Green, the court convicted him of rape and murder of Abir Qasim Hamza al-Janabi, as well as the murder of her father, mother, and 6-year-old sister in their house in Mahmoudiya, and sentenced him to life imprisonment without parole. Green's four accomplices were also found guilty of complicity in the murder, but they saw their sentences reduced because they were cooperative. James Barker pleaded guilty to rape and murder as part of a plea agreement requiring him to give evidence against the other soldiers to avoid the death penalty. He was sentenced to 90 years in prison and must serve 20 years before being considered for parole, followed by a dishonorable discharge. Paul Cortez pleaded guilty to rape, conspiracy to rape, and four counts of murder as part of a plea deal to avoid the death penalty. He was sentenced to 100 years in prison, followed by a dishonorable discharge. Spielman was sentenced to 110 years in prison, with the possibility of parole after 10 years, followed by a dishonorable discharge. Brian Howard was sentenced to and served a 27-month sentence and was dishonorably discharged. The conviction of this group did not end the presence of U.S. forces in Iraq, nor did it prevent the rape and massacre of Iraqis by other American forces. Some estimates put the number of civilian deaths and rapes in Iraq following and during the U.S.-led invasion and occupation of the country at hundreds of thousands.
IRIB English Radio.